Hello and welcome to Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. This week, why is science important? Our guest, teacher and filmmaker Alam Shahar, gives us his thoughts and those of a load of scientists.
I'd like to respond to those who say that the importance of science lies in technology. I think that point of view simplifies both disciplines. I think we in the West need to stand back and ask ourselves, do we need more MP3 players when in fact people in poorer countries don't have access to clean drinking water?
The latest update from the doctors who climbed Mount Everest. Mike Grocott tells us what the daredevils behind Extreme Everest, who took blood at the peak of the world's highest mountain, learnt for science.
As we're sitting here now, the level of oxygen in our blood is about 12 to 14. And by the time you get close to the summit of Everest, we were seeing measurements between about 2.5 and just under 4. You really only see it in a clinical setting, certainly in normal adults, if they're close to being in cardiac arrest. So they'd be unconscious and somebody would be resuscitating them actively.
And a machine that can put scientists out of business, chickens that can do arithmetic, and robots controlled by thought alone. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Hello and welcome to the studio regulars, Nell, Ian, both. Hello, how are you? Not seen you
hello.
For a while.
Hi, Alan. Well, have you had a nice holiday?
I've been really well, actually. How have you been?
Really well.
Ian.
Not so well.
How was the pod thing while I was away?
I really enjoyed it, actually.
Did you?
Power. Yeah, it's extraordinary.
You found power?
It was rushed to my head.
Where did you find that power?
In your seat.
In my seat. It's a powerful seat. And Nell, how's the job? That's a power job. She just giggles whenever we talk about that.
Scary.
Let's ignore that. Our guest this week is Alam Shahar. He's a physics teacher at Camden School for Girls and also a filmmaker. His abiding passion, though, is to spread the gospel of science. Before we start talking to him, here's a clip from one of his little films. He's asking science teachers why science is important.
Why is science important?
It's quite a difficult question, I suppose.
It's quite a hard question.
What a question. Why is science important?
It's a question that you should ask yourself.
Science is important because it's everywhere. It's one of those fundamental subjects that creeps into everyday life because it informs every single thing we do.
Important issues like global warming and MRSA and obesity.
I don't think it's necessarily a question that people ask themselves very often.
So, Alam, explain to us what we just heard there.
That was a bunch of trainee science teachers from the Institute of Education. And you might think it was a bit unfair to ask them the question, but one of the shocking things I found in making the film was that hardly any of the teachers I approached could actually answer that question, why is science important? And even with a great deal of prompting, still couldn't come up with a decent answer, in my opinion. And we often got the response, you know, science is everywhere. And when we said, well, what do you mean by that? They were like, well, you know, gadgets and fridges and things like that. And my view is that it doesn't really matter that we live in a technological world in terms of trying to get children to appreciate the importance of science. You know, every kid's got an iPod in his pocket, a mobile phone, and trying to say to a kid, you know, science gave you your iPod, you know, isn't really something that's going to make that child necessarily want to learn about science. And also, a lot of teachers and science communicators try to spread the message that science is fun. And frankly, that's a message that I think is trite.
Science isn't fun, is that what you're saying?
No.
Well,
science can be fun, but not in the way that I think is implied by people who go into classrooms and start blowing things
Look,
up.
We're making volcano. You know,
there's a intellectual satisfaction and enjoyment to be had from science. And that's not necessarily the message that is conveyed by people who go into schools with kind of liquid nitrogen and make bananas into hammers or whatever.
Well, before we destroy the science communication community, to step back a bit, yeah. Why did you get involved in this project? Why did you want to know about people's intellectual appreciation for science in the first place?
I first started teaching soon after graduating from university, and I only taught for a couple of years before going into TV, and then spent 6 or 7 years working, writing for science programmes and working with mostly Adam Hart Davis, bizarrely. And I went back to teaching part-time. To be brutally honest, I felt that I wasn't doing anything terribly worthwhile with my life. And I thought, you know, I remembered that teaching had felt like I was doing something useful. And I kind of wanted to have that feeling again. And upon returning to the classroom, I kind of thought, hold on a minute. Now, firstly, the syllabus has changed and that's a different conversation. But we're not really conveying to them why science is important. And since I had been a TV producer, I thought, well, you know, here's an opportunity to make a TV program that might get that across. And so I kind of raised some money and did it.
So the idea was to interview scientists, people interested, that kind of thing, and teachers as well, asking them this one question, why is science important? Take us through some of the answers. What are some of your good and bad highlights?
Okay, the bad highlights is the kind of standard response that we live in a technological world.
Why is that a bad response? I mean, in some ways,
I think a lot of people.
If you think about it, I mean, it's a fairly valid thing for a valid way for a teacher or a journalist or a science communicator or whoever to say, look, you're clearly not interested in what is a very hard subject, but I can make you interested because you're interested in something else, so I can connect those things. Why is that an invalid way of doing it?
Because. I think if you think that answer through properly, yes, it can be a good answer. But I think a lot of people who give that answer haven't thought it through properly. I think they just think we live in a world surrounded by gadgets. Look, we've got the internet, and therefore science is important. But, you know, I work with children, and I don't think they engage with technology and think, I'm really grateful that I've got Facebook, and God bless Newton for giving us ultimately Facebook. I don't think they think that. And I think, you know, science has got much more to offer us than technology, and that's why it was so depressing to come across so many people who immediately said technology instead of what I think are far better answers, which we did eventually find.
Well, let's talk about some of those better answers. Who stuck out in your mind as some of the answers where you thought, God, I'm glad I'm doing this project?
I think a lot of people skirted around the issue. I think there's a lot of modesty amongst scientists, believe it or not, and so. The person who really stood out for me was Michael de Podesta, who's a physicist at the National Physical Laboratory and also happens to be a former teacher of mine from UCL. And he just went out and said it. He said, science is humanity's greatest cultural achievement. And that's what I think.
We'd listened to a clip, but he wrote you this, didn't
yes,
he?
So he did.
Why don't you introduce another clip which you liked?
Okay, I think kind of Mark Miodovnik touched on the same point, and he did it in a very interesting way. He said science is your mum, and that doesn't really make any sense unless you hear him explain that.
Science is part of culture, I think that's what I'm going to say. And so I just don't feel like it's more important than literature, and I don't think it's more important than TV or film, but I think it's as important, and it doesn't, you know, at the moment it's underappreciated in that sense, and I guess I feel like it's part of who we are. It's part of being human is science. It's not different from being human. It is what makes you human. Ignoring science and feeling science is kind of irrelevant to you. It's a bit like dissing your mum, you know? It's just like it's where you've come from. You haven't got to appreciate it, but it is a bit like dissing your mum. And it's a bit rude, isn't it, to diss your mum? You shouldn't do that. And people diss science in the same way, and they really shouldn't do that. It's your mum.
So science is your mum. Let me open this out to the pod now. Nell, you're our intellectual powerhouse here. What do you think? Do you think that Alam's point is fair, that it should be more than technology?
The thing that I thought was it's about explanation, and it's about the power of being able to explain stuff. And you come across people who haven't had a scientific background, and they want to know, they want explanations, but they're just unable to generate themselves or them for themselves or try and find out about them. And so I think that it is worth examining why science is important and getting a bit more kind of sophisticated about and bold and immodest about it. Yes, absolutely.
Ian?
I was more interested in the question of why might people want to do science? And I think there's very little sort of emphasis put on just the reward that scientists get from what they do. And looking at historically through some of the sort of great achievements of some scientists, I mean, their stories are just overwhelmingly sort of fascinating and challenging, and their lives must have been truly, genuinely exciting. And this was through, you know, what they did as a job. And there are so many jobs that I can think of that are important that I don't want to do because I just don't think they'll have any kind of intellectual challenge whatsoever. And I think that is something that just doesn't really come out in sort of selling science, if you like. I mean, it's all blowing up custard and making things gloopy.
It's kind of, it really moved me by the end of the project that, you know, I thought, God, these are the people who should be going out and selling science to students and not these stupid people who dress up in lab coats and blow stuff up. I think my personal experience is, you know, the 14, 15 year olds I teach, you know, I can see the moment when they're intellectually engaged. I can see them starting to think about things differently, you know, from things about whether God exists or not, through when I teach them about the Big Bang, to, you know, why are we scared of Iran? And children have an answer to that after they've learned a little bit about radioactivity, you know, and those kinds of ways of engaging children, I think, have a far longer reaching effect than saying, you know, with science, we can make fireworks. And it's just like, who cares?
Actually, teaching is a profession that you have a bit of an issue with. You're a teacher, but the current education system doesn't allow kids to be engaged by science in any sort of difficult way. It's too simple, or what? What's your problem with
that? At the risk of, you know, upsetting some of my colleagues and stuff, you can get a good grade in GCSE science without having to apply yourself intellectually. You know, and that's the case. There is strong evidence that we have dumbed down the science GCSE. But what that has resulted in is lots of people getting really good GCSE science grades. So how are we going to turn that around and actually make the GCSE more challenging? Because if we do that, then surely that will mean that less children get good GCSE grades. And there's a tension there, and I don't know how we resolve it, but I think we have to for the future of science in this country.
Well, Tim Radford, our former science editor, once wrote that, about this. This is this issue actually about science being hard and how we teach it in schools and so on. And he just said, look, guys, just get used to it. Science is hard.
Yes.
And so don't try and make it easier. Absolutely. So only some people are going to be able to do it. We'll leave that stuff there. You can read Alom's column on some of these issues at the Science blog. Alom also has a website featuring all his clips and essays at whyscience.co.uk. So we'll go and have a look at that. Now let's have a look at some of this week's news stories.
News Jack.
Scientists have created a Eureka machine that can work out the laws of nature by observing the world around it, a development that could dramatically speed up the discovery of new scientific truths. The machine took only hours to come up with the basic laws of motion, a task that occupied Sir Isaac Newton for years after he was inspired by an apple falling from a tree. The machine uses a computer program that can search through huge amounts of data and look for underlying patterns.
People left partially blind by a stroke could regain some of their sight after a study has shown they were able to retrain parts of their brains and improve their vision. The exercise regime required patients to spend around an hour a day at a computer for at least 9 months and forced them to process visual signals with parts of their brain that had not been damaged by the stroke.
An elaborate electronic helmet that allows the wearer to control a robot by thought alone has been unveiled by researchers in Japan. It works by processing electrical signals in the brain, just like a standard EEG, and combines this with another technique called near-infrared spectroscopy, which monitors changes in blood flow in the brain. The inventors hope that one day the mind-control technology will allow people to do things like turn air conditioning on or off, or open their car boot without putting their shopping down.
And finally, a study by scientists in Italy has shown that chicks can do impressive arithmetic soon after they hatch. In tests conducted by researchers at the University of Trento, chicks were reared with plastic containers, and when they were hidden from view, they peered first behind the screen that concealed the larger number of containers. In a more difficult test, the containers were then resorted behind the two screens while the chicks watched, and they still made for the screen obscuring the most containers. This suggests they were able to keep track of the number of capsules by adding and subtracting them as they moved.
Nell, Ian, thanks very much. Chicks can do impressive arithmetic. No, they can't. All right, the Eureka machine. The Eureka machine, Ian. I want to know, first of all, who called it the Eureka machine? And is this, you know, is this the end of scientists?
I called it Eureka machine.
Did you?
Yes.
They didn't call it that themselves?
They didn't, no. And apologies to Hod Lipson at Cornell.
I genuinely believe that was in the paper.
No, I coined
you made
that
it.
Term.
Oh yeah. My goodness. Okay, well, tell
us.
Me tell
honestly,
you,
overhyping.
Yeah. Let me tell you why. I don't think it's overhyping at all. What this does is really genuinely interesting, I think. It's an algorithm, a computer algorithm, that you can give a bunch of mathematical operators, multiplication, division, cosine, sine, but far more complex things than that, proper, serious, hardcore, advanced maths. And you can set it to work on a whole bunch of data that you don't understand with multiple variables in. And what it will do is it will just juggle around and crunch different ways of relating the variables and look for invariants, so basically constants, and come up with short lists of equations which explain the behavior of these things. Now, what's really interesting about that is they got it to look at a pendulum. So you feed in data of a pendulum swinging, and it comes back and it churns out Newton's second law, F equals ma. So that's a really easy one. F minus ma is always a constant. It also came up with conservation of momentum laws. Also comes up with, well, it dismissed this because it can dismiss things it thinks are nonsense, but it also realized that the distance between the tip of the pendulum and the pivot of the pendulum was always constant. It just means that the pendulum was the same length throughout the experiment. So it does it from, without any prior knowledge of the system it's looking at, but just builds up a picture of what the natural laws governing a system are. And I think that's truly interesting.
Can I ask a question?
Do they? So some of the laws are discounted as sort of not really relevant. And who discounts them? Is it the machine itself? Or is it scientists looking at the results and going, oh, out of all these equations, like this, this and this are the ones that we think are right?
There's a bit of both. There's a quite a nice evolutionary process built into the algorithm, which I won't go into in detail, but it has ways of working out which variables are likely to be interesting. So it'll come up with an equation, and then it will see how that equation runs when you look at the data and see if it does anything predictive. If it turns out to be just something fairly tedious, like the length of the pendulum it's looking at, it will dismiss it. But then what's interesting about this, it is a machine that actually goes ping and produces a short list of equations. Some of those still will be uninteresting or just telling you things which you're just not, you know, particularly worthwhile. But some might give you, it gives you an insight of then where to look.
It's all very well, though, that for it to be coming up with the laws of motion or how a pendulum swings or something like this. But has it discovered anything new, or how will it discover something new? Because, I mean, looking through lots of data and looking for potential ways that you could be connected, it's almost like the Bible code. It's you could do that with any sort of data. And I used to do that with my maths projects when I was doing GCSE. It doesn't mean that I'm doing science, though.
What they've already done is they've used this this computer to look at a really complex process. So what's going on with metabolites coming out of biological cells? And this is something where you have all sorts of sort of chemicals coming in and out of a cell, levels going up and down over time. As the cell ages, things change. As the cell's energy changes. And these are very complex problems that people don't have underlying sort of equations for. And it's already started kicking out some equations, which they are now staring at and saying, what does this mean? So they know the equations work because they can be predictive of the cell's behavior. And the idea is you can take that equation and then use that to try and then look to try and understand it yourself. So the idea is absolutely to try and direct this at problems that haven't been solved, where you have these massive data sets that you just don't understand.
I wonder if you could call something like this algorithm, if you can call this artificial intelligence or intelligence in any way, or is it still quite sort of mindless, sort of hacking through numbers and things? Let's move on to the brain control story. So this is where a specially equipped helmet can help you control a robot. I think it's the Honda Asimo robot. Before I get onto this, Ian, give you a break. Alom, this is kind of cool, isn't it? It's a cool science thing.
I don't think it's a new story, to be honest. I think they've had helmets that you can put on that can move a cursor around on a screen, and I think they've just adapted that. I mean
in terms of making people excited about science.
I suspect, to be honest, my students would kind of go, so what?
Your student's the cleverest A-level physics student in the world.
Honestly, it's just like, okay, it's a robot, it moves its arm up and down.
Okay, most teenagers go, so what?
Yeah, that's right, that's right.
Ian, explain this to us.
What I quite like about it is it's a commercial system, essentially, that uses two different techniques for looking at your brain activity. So you have your classic EEG, you know, just looking at electrical activity through your scalp, and then it also uses something called near-infrared spectroscopy to look at blood flow in the brain. And by combining both of those, they've been able to sort of put all that those signals through to a computer and then look at patterns that appear in your brain. If I think I'm going to move my right arm up, it sees a distinctive pattern from if I think I'm going to move my left arm or my right leg. And then they're feeding that through to their Asimo robot and getting it to perform that action. And it's gimmicky, no doubt, but it's quite good fun. And I love the whole idea of them. They have a little video with it saying that, yeah, one day we'll be able to sort of go around with these sort of discreet-looking hats, putting our AC on and opening our boots. But if you look at the system today, it's like this wonderful sort of thing from the 60s where the hat in this case is the size of half a beach ball. It's also attached to computing, physically attached to a big block of computing, which is bigger than my fridge. And so you're not going to be sort of wandering around the house with it, sort of with your Asimo following you. It's a solution looking for a problem.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Nell and Ian, for those stories. Nell's got to leave now to go to some important meeting. But if you want more on any of those stories, go to guardian.co.uk/science.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
We've had plenty of discussion here in the pod in the past about Extreme Everest. This was a project by a team of doctors at University College London to study the effects of high altitudes and low oxygen on the human body. The scientists wanted to use the information to help improve survival of intensive care patients. They scaled Everest last year, and the results of their research have been dribbling out ever since. Mike Grocott, who's a consultant in intensive care in Southampton General Hospital and a researcher at the Institute of Child Health at UCL in London, was a member of the Intrepid team. Ian Sample spoke to him for an update on what the team had hoped to achieve up the world's highest mountain.
What we set out to do was to understand the differences between people in the way that they adapt to low oxygen levels. And the reason that we wanted to do that was because most of us come from a critical care background where you look after critically ill patients day to day. And all our patients have problems with hypoxia or low oxygen levels. However, it's very difficult to study in our patients because so many other things are going on. The advantage of looking at healthy individuals going to altitude is that the single thing that's changing is the oxygen level that they're breathing. So you can separate out the effects of that. Now, we recognise it's not a perfect model, but an awful lot of the information that we currently use and refer to in critical care comes from cellular models or rat studies, and we think there's a significant advantage in studying whole human integrative physiology.
And so before we get on to what happened on the mountain, what is it that causes low oxygen in these patients, and what kind of problems can that cause them?
If your lungs are damaged, so pneumonia would be a simple example, then it's difficult for oxygen to get from the atmosphere into the blood. If the heart is not working well and the oxygen is not pumped well around the body, if you're anemic, there's not much oxygen carried in the blood. And then there are some more complex problems where the handling of oxygen either in the very small blood vessels or in the cells is different. So we know that what we call multiple organ failure, when many of the organs in the body stop working, often associated with major infections, the cells in the body start to do something that's quite similar to hibernation. So they seem to tend to try and switch off. So reduce the amount of oxygen they use, minimise the function that's going on until whatever nastiness there is goes away. And then as the body starts to recover, the cells start to switch on again. And it may be that there are parallels between that and what we see at altitude. Because one of the interesting observations is that in people who are well adapted, they have in their blood the same amount of oxygen as we have at sea level. So they increase their hemoglobin level, the molecule that carries oxygen, and therefore they can carry the same amount of oxygen in their blood. And yet they're profoundly disabled. The amount of exercise they can do is much less. And so it's not that the limitation of oxygen is explaining why they can't do things. It's something about the way they've adapted that means they've turned down their machine, they've turned down their ability to exercise, because that's beneficial in some way.
And so on the mountain, presumably the idea is that the higher you go, the less oxygen there is in the atmosphere.
That's right.
And so were you going to different altitudes, taking blood oxygen levels? And then if you were doing that, what were you using that for exactly?
Exactly so. We measured blood oxygen in a number of different ways. Now, for our volunteers, the nearly 200 people that went to base camp, we didn't want to stick needles into their arteries. So we could use a probe on the finger, which gives us an index of how much oxygen there is there. For our investigators, we actually did stick needles into arteries, in fact, right up to 8,400 metres, and were able to get a very precise measurement. Interestingly, the measurement that we got at the highest point is the lowest that we can find in humans, and in fact, close to the lowest that there is in non-hibernating mammals. As we're sitting here now, the level of oxygen, the unit is kilopascals, but the level of oxygen in our blood is about 12 to 14. At Everest Base Camp, the pressure in the blood would be about 6 or 7, and by the time you get close to the summit of Everest, we were seeing measurements between about 2.5 and just under 4.
And so normally, if you saw that in a clinical setting, would you think that person is in particular trouble?
Yeah, I mean, you really only see it in a clinical setting, certainly in normal adults, if they're close to being in cardiac arrest. So they'd be unconscious and somebody would be resuscitating them actively, and yet they were functioning normally. They were able to talk fluently, take these samples, walk around.
It can't be easy taking these samples at that kind of altitude. Can you just paint a picture for me of how this kind of thing is done?
The aim was to take them on the very summit, and in fact we decided not to do that because there was about 20 knots of wind and it was minus 25 degrees C, and you're encased in these huge boots, mittens, two pairs of gloves, several inner layers, and then a huge down suit. And certainly in those conditions we weren't prepared to get out of our little cases. We descended about 400 metres to a relatively sheltered area called a balcony. We unzipped the down suits down to just below our waist, and then basically just pulled back the thermal underwear and stuck a needle in the artery in the groin.
And so how's this work now going to help, do you think, in hospitals and such like?
I think the although the very high measurements are very interesting, they're fascinating physiologically, I think they will help less. I think the great strength will be in the large group of individuals who followed exactly the same ascent to base camp. And we can compare how they adapted to the low oxygen levels. So there's a broad spectrum of response. Some people are much less affected than others. And we can relate that to their genetics. And so we can identify particular associations between specific genes and the ability to adapt well or perhaps badly. And then look back and see what those genes do and start to understand how, why it is, what the mechanisms are that people have these beneficial or adverse adaptations. It's quite complex analysis that's involved, but then we can relate together the genetics, the physiological profile, and these complex other measurements to understand why it is that some people do well and some people do less well.
That was Mike Grocott speaking to Ian Sample. Ian, is Mike Grocott one of your heroes, given he's a climber who's climbed Everest and you're a wannabe climber?
I've got an enormous amount of respect for him, but what was interesting, it turns out he works at Southampton General Hospital, where my real-life, all-time, just untouchable hero works.
Who is that?
It's Mike Stroud.
Randolph Fiennes' doctor.
Exactly. Sort of, you know, the guy who did a lot of the polar expeditions with Randolph Fiennes, who was alongside him when they ran 7 marathons in 7 continents, you know, a seemingly self-effacing man who is absolutely hard as nails. Full respect to the man.
And I spoke to him once to ask his opinion on whether would you be able to survive in the ocean for 12 days by drinking your own urine. And he sort of sighed over the phone and just said, "No, of course you can't. Don't be stupid." And this is the hardest man in the world. If you're a reader of our science blog, you'll have seen Tim Radford's book club. Last time he kicked off with a discussion on the geologist Richard Fortey's life and unauthorised biography. And we had some interesting comments on the blog. Alum, you've been reading up. What did you like from that discussion?
One of the comments that resonated with me was by Adam Tutt, who said, "Most of my students doing a science degree at a respectable red brick do not read books about science. Many of them, to my astonishment, have never heard of Richard Dawkins." And that resonated with me because when I started at the school where I teach, there wasn't a reading list given to my science A-level students. And they weren't necessarily expected to go and read science books. There's this culture of saying, you know, read around your subjects, but they weren't presented with a specific list of books. So I quite enjoyed putting a list together myself. And on it, I do include Richard Dawkins' Selfish Gene, despite being a physics teacher. And I also include The Periodic Table by Primo Levi, which I think is the best science book.
And probably one we're going to include in the book club at some point soon. Ian, the next book that Tim's chosen is about the physicist Paul Dirac. Do you want to tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is a lot of books have been written about the sort of the emergence of quantum theory, how that theory was put together over the 20s and the difficulties it went through, you know, throughout the 20s, 30s, 40s and where we are today. But Dirac is, you know, almost certainly the best scientist in Britain's had since Newton. And he is a really interesting character. I mean, this is it's not a short book. It's more than 500 pages, but it takes you through, you know, Paul Dirac's childhood in Bristol with a very dysfunctional father, difficult family, a problematic child himself, no doubt. But then how he gets involved in this huge swirl of this most exciting time in physics, all the way through whole problems of the Second World War, McCarthyism after that. And it's just a fascinating journey, I found.
The book is called The Strangest Man, The Hidden Life of Paul Dirac. And here's a passage. Here, Paul Dirac's wife is away and he's struggling to compose a love letter.
Mansi was with her children in Budapest. About once a week in her spidery hand, she sent Dirac 4 lively pages of news and gossip, urging him to keep in close contact. Unaccustomed to receiving warm and attentive letters, Dirac struggled to respond.
"I'm afraid I cannot write such nice letters to you. Perhaps my feelings are so weak and my life so mainly concerned with facts and not feelings."
Mansi, very much upset by this statement, knew that she would have to take the initiative if she were to stir in him the first quantum of romance. Always wearing her heart on her sleeve, she wrote to Dirac about her family and bombarded him with questions about his life in Princeton in all its minutiae. After she complained that he didn't answer all her questions, he reread her letters, numbered them, and sent her tabulated responses to every question he had ignored, including...
Letter number 5, question.
What makes me, Mansi, so sad?
Answer. You have not enough interests.
Whom else could I love?
You should not expect me to answer this question. You would say I was cruel if I tried.
You know that I would like to see you very much.
Yes, but I cannot help it.
When Mansi received the list, she thought Dirac was jeering at her, but eventually decided that it was quite funny. Beginning to realise that Dirac didn't understand rhetorical questions, she seethed. Most of them were not meant to be answered.
So, Ian, are you through the book at all? Or?
Yeah. There's something interesting, actually, which ties Dirac's method of working back to one of the stories we were talking about, this sort of Eureka machine idea, where Dirac was maybe one of the first people who really had faith in the beauty of mathematical equations. And he would say, don't worry if your equations don't match the experimental data. Find these equations, which just seem so beautiful, they almost certainly point to something. And then go and test them and see whether actually they predict something that might suggest the experiment was wrong. Sort of such was his confidence in, maybe overconfidence at times, in beauty being truth. But he just had a real reliance on this. And it was a really interesting way to work. And the Freeman Dyson described this as, he said, his discoveries were like exquisitely carved statues falling out of the sky one after another. He seemed able to conjure laws of nature from pure thought. And I just thought that was, he was remarkable in that aspect, unique.
It's beautiful, but it sounds like a religion to me, this physics thing. Well, the book is called The Strangest Man, The Hidden Life of Paul Dirac, A Quantum Genius. It's written by Graham Farmelow, and we'll be discussing it on the Science Blog. Now, Alan, before we let you go, I just want to ask one more thing about your project. We've heard about your project. What are you going to do next?
I'm kind of looking into investigating a couple of things. I'm really interested in the science in Africa. I think science has a huge role to play in Africa, but I also think African scientists have a huge role to play in science, and that's something I'd like to investigate and explore. And I've mentioned that I'm actually interested in examining how we've arrived at the state we are in with science education in this country, so that's something I'm going to be looking into.
Okay, well, Alan, thanks so much for that. You can see all his clips and essays at whyscience.co.uk, and also some of them are on our blog. Thanks also to Ian and Nell. Until next week, I'm Alok Jha. The programme was produced this week by Scott Cawley. Thanks for listening.